daughter, right?
Good afternoon. I'm going to call the Tax Committee to order, and we were on, members, the policy bill. So I think where we left it, we want to try to get through the policy bill and the technical bill today if possible. We're already on the second hearing on this, or second day of hearings on this bill. So we were on Article 4. We were taking public testimony. I recall there was somebody here who we said would be first. Here he is. Yes, welcome to the committee. So members, we're back on, was it House File 2972? Is that the policy? The House File 2972. If you go back and dig out, members, out of your packets, the summary of the policy bill, we are on section, article, just hang on a second here. Article 4. Is that right? Article 4, section 1. So it's page 3, members, of the summary. Welcome to the committee. If you can tell us again who you are and you wanted to talk to us, I think, about a case. Welcome.
Thank you, Justice. My name is Steve Bedore. I'm representing Bedore Enterprises, a small business in Chanasson, which owns 5 small properties in Chanasson, 4 in the Carver County side and 1 in the Hennepin County side. Chris, can you hear me okay this far away from the microphone?
I can hear you, but a lot of the room is still talking. So talk louder for a little while until we get the message. Okay.
So
Mr. Bedore.
The topic I was speaking to had to do with subdivision 5 of 270.41, in which there's been a request to allow county assessors to act as appraisers for tax court testimony, which is currently prohibited by subdivision 5. We also heard last week that the county represented that they have been ignoring the subdivision for several years. Having gone through tax court, I want to offer just 4 unintended consequences when a county is allowed to put an assessor on the stand as an independent appraiser. So what I'd like to do is lap through those 4 and then open to questions. And if there is time, one of the questions someone had in the committee last week was trying to get your arms around what kind of cost you're looking at if you don't carve out this exemption. And I did some research in January reviewing every tax case in the last 2 years, so I have some data that might shed some light on that. But let me just talk about my 4 unintended consequences. First, if you have in your packet my handout that has yellow highlighting. Again, one of the properties is in Hennepin County, and one of the things I do routinely each year for Bedore Enterprises is kind of track the changes. And that column that's highlighted just shows this particular property how it's changed over time. And you can see for the first 98 through 04, pretty typical increases you'd expect. In 05, there was a 23% jump, but again, having the benefit of other properties which are listed to the right, 1, 2, 3, and 4. The 23% increase was in line with the increases of the property, so again, not alarming. Any success in finding that?
We've all got it. Continue, because we're trying to get through all the testimony and a whole other bill, so continue, please.
When it goes up to 800,000 and 880 within the next 2 years, and yet the other properties, the Bedore Enterprise owns, is no change, then it raises the flag. Not that it's wrong. We'd be very happy if it was worth 880 and it's just doubled my money. Because as a business, without any emotional attachment, we would look at the sell equation. But I also know from my experience that before I go to an assessor to first get data and do some research. And in Carver County, I would routinely get a regular appraisal with $500 and go in and talk to my assessor about that. In Hennepin County, they have a much different, more aggressive reputation. So I hired a MAI certified appraiser, the highest certification. And for $2,000, he provided a preliminary overview for me. And that overview showed a lesser value. So I sent to the assessor that preliminary data, which include 4 pages, including a sales test report, to show that based on the sales comparable, the cost approach, etc., to have some sort of opening dialogue. The response from the assessor's office was rather brief. It said that we have also searched for comparables, especially related to auto-type businesses, which is what my tenants are, and found that the sales support the assessed values for all years. Should you have an appraisal completed, then we'd be willing to discuss the merits of our case and their valuation. So basically what they're telling me is unless I want to spend another $12,000 for a litigation appraisal, they weren't talking to me. Now, how does Subdivision 5 have anything to do with this? Well, by being able to ignore Subdivision 5, to go to court, there's no repercussion to them in terms of out-of-pocket cost. So it comes down to who blinks last, because the cost to go to court is so high that obviously the taxpayer is going to blink first. The county never has to. If you look at my handout,
we've all got it, members. It's got yellow on it.
Under minimum, just showing some of the costs a taxpayer faces, minimum. The expert witness with a half day of testimony, $13,000. The co-reporter, $1,800. The attorney, $25,000. So the taxpayer is looking at $40,000. In order for this to make sense, the difference between under dispute has to be at least $1.3 million for me to even have a chance to break even. If I protest 2 years, the difference has got to be $660,000. If it's 3 years, it's got to be $442,000. The difference in appraisal in my case was only $260,000. So it makes no economic sense at all for me. The cost is too prohibitive for me to cost of admission to go to court. The assessors know that. They know they'll have no out-of-pocket, so I was ignored. That was the first unintended consequence. The second one I would call punish. I was warned that before I show my cards to the assessor's office that there would be a reaction, and I could very well start off with a number that's much higher than the assessed value I'm questioning. And I said, well, what do you mean? This is to attorneys and expert witnesses that swim in these waters. And they say there's nothing that says the assessor has to start with 880, the assessed value. He can start with a much higher number. I don't really believe that. We decided to go to court. And my expert witness appraisal from the MAA was $620,000. The assessed value was $880,000. And the county came in at $1.1 million. Couldn't understand, well, how can they justify such an inflated appraisal? And as well, because they don't need to use an independent MAI appraiser, they're held a different standard than I, the taxpayer. I could be an appraiser, I could be an MAA appraiser, but I would not be allowed to give testimony, or my testimony would be challenged as not being independent. But an assessor acting as an appraiser for his current boss within his county is allowed to act as an independent appraiser. So again, because of Subdivision 5 of 274.1, the county was able to create a appraisal much higher than the assessed value. And remember, going back to the response from the county, they said before this, they said, we've searched all comparables, especially related to auto type uses, and found that the comparable sales support the assessed values for all years. So just a few weeks before, they confirmed that their analysis confirmed the 880, but when they go to court, $1.1 million. So I call that punishment. The third unintended consequence was bleed. Again, I was warned by several others, including an MAI appraiser, that Hennepin County does not appreciate the arrogance of a small business taxpayer taking them to court on something so small as this, and they're going to bleed me to death. And I said, what do you mean bleed me to death? They said, well, when I do $150 million hospital complexes and I'm appearing in court, I usually figure a day testimony max. He said, but I had a small Midas muffler shop in Brooklyn Center, similar to yours, where it made no sense to go to court from a financial standpoint. And the I set a record. He said the county attorney kept me on the stand for a day and a half over a little, what, $600,000 or $700,000 property. Well, I must really shook up the or smacked the hornet's nest, because in my case, my MAI assessor was on the stand for 3 days. My trial was 6 days. So think for a minute, if you're an attorney, some of you are, if you're going to ask questions regarding two little 3,000 square foot buildings, what level of minutiae you need to get to fill up 3 days of cross-examination? Again, that, and this is all on my nickel. So I have an expert witness at a couple thousand a day, the attorney, the court reporter, and to stretch this trial out from a day to 6 days, I understood all of a sudden what they meant by you'll be bled to death. The fourth unintended consequence was waste. Waste of the court's time with a inferior appraisal. My MAI independent certified appraiser submitted his appraisal. I think it was 160 pages, no corrections, no errors. The county's independent assessor acting as appraiser, with two assessors authoring this bill, one which was a 20-plus year veteran, submit their 80-page appraisal. But then, right after that, two more exhibits, exhibit 118 and 119, 10 pages encompassing 52 changes and corrections to their appraisal. And those did affect the conclusions at the end. So not only did that point to the caliber of the work in my mind, but also it was a waste of court time, because every time there's a question regarding some issue, we had to look at this appraisal, cross-reference to Exhibit 118 to see if that changed, cross-reference to 119 to see if that changed. So again, if the concern was, if we don't change Subdivision 5, we're going to raise costs for the county, my experience was there didn't seem to be the same cost-benefit analysis to the process as I, as a taxpayer, go through. One last example in terms of wasting time. Both the MAI certified appraiser and the assessor's appraisal broke out the property in various components. Two components were nearly identical. How they treat the valuation for surplus land and valuation for a lean-to. The county spent about a third of the time testimony, about a full day, debating those two items. To give you an idea what we're talking about, the surplus land, the difference in tax between, the little difference there was between my appraisal and the assessor's appraisal, was $173. The difference in tax between the lean-to, between my appraisal and the county's, was $300. We spent a day over $500. There's four attorneys in the room and a judge. So put them each at $3,000 a day. That's $15,000. We have the court reporter at just under $2,000 a day. We have an expert witness at about $3,000 a day. We have two county assessors, let's put them at $1,000, $2,000 a day. Plus, at any given time from the county was 1 to 5 people in the gallery watching this. So that was over $24,000 of both taxpayer money and my money directly being wasted debating over 500. So again, enforcing Subdivision 5 removes an intimidation tactic that's employed by the counties, at least in my case. Now, if you think I exaggerate, please challenge me, because I didn't believe it when I was told this before I pulled the trigger. If you think it's an isolated case, again, please challenge me, because I have other cases I can cite with similar treatment. If you think I was recruited to be here and somehow invited to be here and that diminishes my testimony, again, I'd love to talk about that. If you think that contingency fees levels the playing field for taxpayers, I would love to talk about that.
Thank you, Mr. Bedard. Members, I'm going to ask, we have four amendments on this provision, and we have a whole rest of the policy to build to get through and the technical bill to get through, and we're not even halfway through the policy bill. How many other folks, because we want to get the testimony done on this provision, how many other people want to testify on this provision? Can anybody raise their hand if you want to talk? We still have quite a few more. Okay, please come forward. Who would else like to testify on this? We're not going to take all these amendments on this provision until we get through all the public testimony. Please. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and other members of the committee. My name is Lisa Hahn-Cordes. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I practice in the area of property tax appeals, and I've been doing this exclusively for about 8 years now. I was involved with the case for the witness who was just testifying previous to mine, Mr. Bedard. I sat through and was a second chair in that case. That matter is still under litigation, and there's only one point that I would like to make with that case. The court excluded all of the testimony and all of the appraisal report that was submitted by the county assessors in that case. So the only evidence that was before the court when the judge made its decision was that of Mr. Bedard's MAI real estate appraiser. And if you look at the court's decision, she discounted everything that that appraiser did and basically had to affirm the valuation of the property because of the errors and all of the other issues that she had with Mr. Bedard's expert's appraisal report. That's all I want to say about that case. What I am here to tell you is the issue that arose and starting in the Shops at Woodbury case in May of 2009 and then again in June of 2009 with the Bedard case and the interpretation of Minnesota Statute 270.41 Subdivision 5, which is the prohibited activity statute. That was the change in the practice and the historical practice of how cases were have been litigated in tax court. Since the beginning, as long as I've been doing it and many years before, I'm looking back maybe 60, 70 years, assessors have always been testifying in tax court cases. They've always done appraisal reports. The court has always looked at what their education, experience, and knowledge is to determine whether or not they're credible, whether or not their reports are admitted into evidence, and whether they are qualified to be an expert witness. And that is all pursuant to the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure and Evidence, Rule 701, for whether you are capable and qualified to become to be an expert in testifying before the court. Assessor licensing itself didn't start until 1971. This practice was in existence long before then, and real estate appraisers licensing didn't start until 1989. And again, assessors and real estate appraisers have been providing appraisal reports and testifying in tax court long before there was any regulation by the Department of Revenue and the Department of Commerce. I believe there was testimony, and I don't want to reiterate some of the stuff that was testified to by Mr. Baker, but the statutory amendment that put into place the 270.41 Subdivision 5 in 1993 was specifically put in place to address the issue where you had a licensed real estate appraiser who was also a licensed assessor, and then those individuals were doing fixed fee appraisal reports at an outside business, not for the jurisdiction that they were employed by, but doing fixed fee appraisal reports on property that they were also doing assessments on. And if you looked at the actual legislative history for the enactment of that provision, that is specifically what it was meant to prohibit, and that is the moonlighting, if you will, of a real estate assessor acting as a real estate appraiser under both licensure, both licensures. There's been a suggestion that to have a level playing field for a taxpayer and the government that it would be only fair for the government to have to pay for an appraisal report. I would only like to look at an analogy to that. That would be similar to someone saying, well, we have a criminal prosecution and the government is going to use the expert witnesses that they have in their police department, the accident reconstruction, maybe a VCA individual. And because the defendant has to go out and hire an independent expert to testify about those exact same issues, the government somehow is prohibited and would have to be precluded from being able to use their own experts, their own staff who have the similar qualifications, the similar knowledge, the similar experience, and the similar education background to testify in any other sort of a litigation instance just because they're not paying an additional fee. The whole point of having assessors on staff is that they are paid. Everyone's salaried. Part of their job duties historically has been to deal with tax court matters. They negotiate with they negotiate with taxpayers on a routine basis and do analyses, have to do individualized appraisal analysis on individual properties, which if you looked at the strict language and how the court has interpreted this statute, they would be prevented from doing that, which would mean the minute the assessment is set in January, from that point on, the government could do no negotiations, could not even speak with anybody with respect to whether the assessment that was set for January might be too high, and they would not be able to get any remedy short of going to trial, short of the government having to hire a real estate appraiser, a licensed real estate appraiser, and incurring the expense to in order to be able to either negotiate a case or to have a case be resolved in a manner that would be appropriate. I did have one of my staff individuals just do some statistical runs for the assessment for January of 2006. This is Hennepin County only. For the pay 2007, there were 987 petitions that were filed, tax court petitions, and that covered 2,114 parcels. So some of the petitions were multi-parceled. Of those petitions to date, 498 of those resulted in a dismissal. That would mean the tax petitioner either was presented with evidence by the assessor that they their assessment was right on, or it was too low. And as things presently are, if someone were to file a tax court petition, the government has no way to maintain an action when they've done an appraisal, which comes in at a higher value. That tax petitioner is able to dismiss their case at the very last minute, the day before trial, and there's no ability for the government to get an increase in value. There's nothing that allows us to sustain a cross-claim against or counterclaim against the tax petitioner. For those paid 2007, there's still 90 open cases, and 385 of that 987 petitions have been stipulated where the assessor and the taxpayer have come to an agreement. And that stipulation doesn't necessarily mean that there's been a reduction. That could be a stipulation that encompasses multi-parcels and that they've stipulated that the assessed value is the correct value for that parcel. Of those 987 petitions, 14 of those went to trial. And of those 14, one resulted in a decrease, and that was one of the six properties that was valued over $5 million. For the pay 2008, there are 1,237 petitions covering 4,061 parcels. Of those, to date, 337 have been dismissed. There's still 367 open. 521 of those have been stipulated, and 10 of those were tried, with two of those resulted in a decrease. One that was a property over $5 million in value, and one that was below $5 million in value. For the pay 2009 taxes, there are 1,883 petitions covering 5,510 parcels. To date, 109 of those have been dismissed. There's still 1,197 open. 452 have been stipulated, and to date, six of those have gone to trial, and none of those have resulted in a decrease in value for the taxpayer. So there are an expectation that the number of petitions are going to be increasing, along with the number of parcels that are going to be increasing. And I would suggest that maintaining the statute as the court has interpreted to be, where the assessors are not able to do an appraisal report, not able to do an analysis, not able to negotiate with the taxpayer, is going to increase the number of cases that go to trial as opposed to decrease them. There is no reason for a taxpayer to not hold the government to requiring them to go out and having to pay between $15,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to get a real estate appraisal. Without them, they wouldn't have to do a thing. They, up until the day of trial, they don't have to produce anything, an appraisal report or otherwise. If they are, you know, they would have no incentive to not make the government incur these costs to try and force them to go into a negotiation where they may or may not have any basis for a value reduction. This puts the tax burden on the government. Represents all the taxpayers in the state. It's not just those who are petitioning. It's not just those who don't petition. It's everybody. And what the assessors try to do to the best of their ability is to make sure that the properties are valued appropriately and that everyone is treated the same, and that we would like to maintain the status quo where the assessors are able and have been able to, up until just recently, provide the government with the ability to do their own appraisal reports and testify as experts in the tax court, and let the tax court judges be the decider of who provides the credible evidence, who is the appropriate person to be qualified as an expert witness, and then make the decision according to what evidence is presented.
Thank you. Before we go to members' questions, members, look what time it is, and we've only heard from two testifiers. So just trying to think this through. We're looking at what nights to schedule this now, because we have a long policy bill to get through, followed by a technical bill, which we thought we would do last meeting. We're not making a lot of headway even in the policy bill, Ms. Canoon. And no, hang on a minute.
Just getting on the list, Madam Chair.
Yes. I think what we're going to have to do, which I never do, is we're going to have to maybe limit testimony here. Many committees give people 2 or 3 minutes. We each had, both of you take a dozen. And this committee usually doesn't hear that sort of that length of that detail, and I feel like we're in civil law now. So, members, it's great, Mr. Bedore and Ms. Han Cortez. We need to hear these opinions, and it's very helpful to us, and I think the committee is sort of divided on this issue. But what I can just tell you, and I think I just want to take a minute to ask committee members what they want to do here, is there are amendments now to strike this provision, moderate it, keep it, whatever. So I think that the committee needs to take a minute to think about, you know, how much time do we want to, let everybody who's here continue on this testimony. My guess is we will get to the end of the tax committee today and we will still be on this item, and that's okay. So we need to do that. I'm just trying to think through, and if I may, before we hear from committee members or go on to other testifiers, I want to ask the assistant commissioner to join us at the table, and if someone could give her a chair, so thank you. So Ms. Han Cortez, you were done with your testimony, right?
Yes.
Okay, so go ahead, Ms. Cadoon. Maybe you can just give us a little insight here. Members, recall this is the department's bill. This is the governor's presentation to us, okay? So now we're going to hear the governor's representative tell us kind of where they're at on wanting to just make good use of time now on this provision, because I apologize, Ms. Cadoon, you tried to reach me, and I have it here now, but I have not read it, and I think your office had offered a potential middle ground amendment, not sure, but maybe we could just talk about, you know, I feel like this really probably needs to go to Mullery's, Representative Mullery's committee. I think we're all sensing that in here. that this probably can't get resolved in here right now, but maybe you can just give us your thoughts before we go further.
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I had asked for this bill also to be introduced separately, so I believe that will be done.
Okay.
With the idea then it could go to Representative Mullery Committee and any other committee that seems appropriate. So hopefully you'll see that introduced shortly, and then it could take that route as well. Our view, though, is also the Department of Revenue does staff the State Board of Assessors. We do have also appoint the members to it, and also have some appointments from the Department of Revenue. So we thought this was a very important provision to be in the Department of Revenue's bill. For that purposes, we want to make sure that the property tax system, you know, works well for all Minnesotans. And this was, as you've heard, was definitely overturning some very long-standing practice for assessors to be able to testify in tax court on property valuation appeals. And as you've heard also, that would also raise the cost for the counties if they have to go outside and do hire outside appraisals. So we definitely do hope this stays in the bill. We think it's very important. We thought it was very important for the legislature to hear because of the provision, this moonlighting provision. If you take a look at it, at some point you can see with the court that was, if you look at the legislative history, was certainly intended just to deal with moonlighting. But if you look at the plain language of the statute, obviously wasn't drafted probably as we had hoped. I think it was the Department of Revenue's point or position in 1993 when it came forward. But once you know for the court, they'll just look at the plain language. They won't look at legislative intent. And so when they looked at the plain language of the statute, their ruling was, yep, it looks like it prohibits assessors from testifying. We know, because we brought the position forward in 1993, that was certainly not the intent. So we thought it was very important for the legislature, if that was the intent, for you to take a look at it and then decide that you really wanted to take this tactic.
Okay. Members, we have Reps. Muller and West and Reps. Coles, but we still have a lot of public testimony. Just to the process here first, before all the detailed questions, how do people want to handle this? I think what we're finding is generally we view these policy and technical bills as something fairly quick, and it's I think we're stuck on a really big issue, and I think it is the purview of the tax committee. I absolutely agree. There's no getting around that. I also think it's got to represent Muller would have to see it. So
no.
Does anybody have thoughts on, you know, how you want to handle this for effective use of time? Representative Mullery, you're on the list first, but I don't know what you were going to say.
Madam Chair, I just had two questions, but I would think that it's going to have to go also to Representative Nelson's committee, local government for sure, I believe. So I think it's probably best to have a separate bill and travel through those procedures. That would seem to me to be the most efficient use, unless you want to have a vote here and kill it completely, but I have no idea where people are on this.
Okay, and we'll keep Representative Mullery on the list for questions, but Representative Coles, thoughts on process here?
Well, it's
not questions to testify.
Right,
yet.
It's an odd day, Madam Chair, when I agree with Representative Mullery, but I agree with Representative Mullery. You know, we can sit and do this for the next 3 days to try to get the department's policy bill out of here, and that's fine. We can do that, but I don't think that's the most efficient use of our time. Let's get these sections out of this bill now, move the rest of the bill forward, and come back and deal with this issue here and in Representative Mullery's committee and Representative Nelson's committee, if that's where it has to go. I do think that this issue is a tax committee issue in addition to the other committees, but to me it doesn't make sense for us to spend the next 3 days talking about a couple sections in this bill when there's some other good things in here that I think aren't controversial. We can move forward and get this bill out of here. So at the appropriate time, Madam Chair, I would be willing to make a motion to get those sections out of this bill. I'll wait until you signal me that there's an appropriate time to take that motion up. But I think we should get on with it. And this obviously needs a lot of work. And I don't know where members are either. I know that a number of members on this side of the table, and I'll include Representative Mullery, I won't say this side of the aisle, would just as soon see this come out, at least for now, and we can deal with it another day.
Other thoughts on process, members, on what you want to do here? Okay. I just want to take 1 second to ask Mr. Michael. I tried to hand him a note here, kind of just to tell us, you know, what part of this is the purview of this committee? This stuff, we're hearing testimony now that there wasn't any law on this till the 80s, so Mr. Michael, I think, was here, and maybe he can just help us think through purview of the committees and what we should be doing as far as making sure everything goes through the process the right way. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this committee traditionally does deal with the procedures governing, tax challenges and appeals, and so this is matter that this committee traditionally deals with. The Judiciary Committee, or now the Civil Law Committee, also obviously deals with these kinds of procedures, and so they're sort of like a joint jurisdiction, and bills of typically changing the process have gone through usually both committees in the past, although I think that's maybe not always universal, but typically they have.
Okay. With that, then, I think if we can finish the testimony on this section, I think I'm getting a sense from members that we're going to have it get off to represent Mallory, but we don't want to have people who came here today to talk to us have to come again. Yep. So if you want to continue with your testimony, I think the best way is to just get through everyone who's got it, but understand that this is going to need a lot more discussion. Please, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and believe it or not, I should try and stick to that 2 minutes for a lawyer. My name is Rick Hodgson with the Washington County Attorney's Office. I'm one of the two lawyers in our office who have been handling tax appeal matters since 2003, and four simple points, and I will be done. One, the issue goes, first of all, as to the question that the witness, I'm not sure what you'll be asking Mr. Bedore, follow-up, if anything. I understand why it would take so long to cross-examine his expert witness, because I did that, and it took me far longer, too. And those of us in the lawyer business know it's because they're a good target. I refer you to the shops of Kohl's Department Store versus Washington County. You'll find that's a case where, with that expert witness, the tax court judge raised the valuation based on the credibility of our assessor versus the very same appraiser, which leads me to my point number two, competency. Based on Washington County's experience, and we handle anywhere between 120 to 150 tax petitions per year since 2003, every case that's gone to trial in which we have had one of our assessors testify on, as an expert on behalf of the county versus an MIA or otherwise certified landowner appraiser, in every single case but one, the tax court has seen fit to raise the valuation, indicating that, if anything, Washington County has been generous to its landowners. In that one case where they did not do that, Shops of Woodbury, our appraiser was not allowed to testify by this precedent-setting ruling. Had they been allowed to, their testimony would have indicated that the value should have gone up on that case as well. So in terms of competency, I think that's a red herring. We have highly qualified, competent assessors. They do their job. They do it well. Third, as to costs, my suggestion to you, if this bill is not passed, its effect for taxpayers, you've all realized, of course, is going to significantly increase. Secondly, I suggest to you, based on the Washington County experience, it is going to double the cost of a tax appeal for the taxpayer. Because under the rules of civil procedure, which these are governed by, I, as the prevailing party, should I get an increase in valuation, get my costs and assessments, including expert witness fees, assessed against that taxpayer. So if it costs the prior witness $25,000 in expert witness fees, if I prevail, and prevailing means they don't get a reduction. So if I hold the line or it goes up, that $25,000 in expert witness fees now became $50,000 that they're going to pay the tax, that they can be paying, ordered to pay to the tax entity. So that's my third point. My fourth and final point is, I know you've heard testimony from members of the Minnesota Bar Association Tax Division opposing this change. I want to let you know that I've been a member of this Minnesota Bar Association since being admitted to the bar in 1978. That entity does not speak for all of us, and frankly, I'm disappointed in the position it took. I feel sometimes the tax section is the captive of the developers, the large landowners, that forgets about the small fry taxpayer. This is not about mom and pop taxpayer getting ripped off by a heartless, cruel county. It just doesn't happen that way. This is large scale, sophisticated developers. They may have one small business in one place, but if you look at their overall business structure, they are large and they are big. This is the Kohl's department stores of this world, the Shops Woodbury by a major developer. That's who's bringing this action and opposing this change.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchins. Further testifiers? I'd like to get the public testimony done on this provision. So you left, or you changed your mind. Okay, great. So we are through the public testimony on this section, correct? Okay, all the people who raised their hands changed their minds, so that's good. Okay, so before we go on to the next one then, members, I'll just tell you straight up, the little bit I know about it, I kind of am with the assessors and the cities and counties here. On the other hand, I think that the civil law needs to think this through, and I think it needs to be heard by them and come back. So unless people have a issue with that, I guess I'll go ahead and move that House File 2972 be back before us for purposes of taking the Coles Amendment, unless anyone has any issues with that. So now House File 2972 is before us. We will lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, but we want to get the amendments done to mark up the policy and technical bill. So Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, and I may need some help from Mr. Michael, but I believe that my amendment would be to delete Article 4, Sections 1, 2, 3, and 8.
Mr. Michael. I'll ask Mr.
Not 3?
Not
3. 1, 2, and 8.
Okay, so Representative Coles moves to delete Article. Well, we'll have Mr. Michael repeat the motion. How's that? Into the tape. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the amendment would be to move to amend House File 2972, Article 4, delete Sections 1, 2, and 8.
That's my amendment.
Okay, thank you. Discussion to the amendment. Either side, folks. I think we need to get it out here for other chairs who are going to hear this. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. It does seem to me that we're caught kind of in a professional tug of war here about credibility, but I also think it's also about what do we expect out of our public assessors, and I think they've developed competence. They ought to be able to defend their employer and justify their work, and I think we ought to not put that additional new burden upon our local governments. I had suggested to the chair last week that if this moves forward, we might want to look at a local impact fiscal note about the impacts on it. I do think our witness has raised some questions about whether or not our tax court is as efficient as it could be in handling small cases and the number of days and hours and those sorts of things, but that's not the issue before us. It's about who's qualified, and so I would support the department's proposal.
Further discussion from committee members on this motion? Yeah. Representative Liebling, please.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm not so sure that taking this out at this time is the right way to do it. I certainly think that it should be considered in Representative Mullery's committee, and I understand there's that the separate bill that somebody mentioned. I don't know if that's already been filed. But is there a reason why we couldn't just keep this and hang on to it and let that other bill, which with, I assume, the same language as this section, make its way? I'm just uncomfortable taking this out at this time because, I kind of feel like I'm between a rock and a hard place here because I kind of want to stick with this language. I don't want to vote to take it out. At the same time, I want it to be able to move through the right way and get full consideration because I do think it needs to go to civil law.
Well, Representative Liebling, I think we're kind of stuck in the take it out column. I'll tell members, I went and visited with Representative Mullery after the last committee meeting in hopes to convince him to only have an informational hearing on this provision so we weren't having to act. They could hear it and let us know what they thought. I don't think Representative Mullery wanted to do that, and so I'm not comfortable sending the Department of Revenue's total policy bill to civil law. So now we've got a tax bill sitting over in civil law, and I can understand Representative Mullery wants to have possession of this piece. So I think the way we can properly send the message for now is to remove it, to take Representative Mullery at his word that he's going to hear it as it's introduced as another bill, and then we'll hear back. Of course, this committee in the end will have the omnibus tax bill, and we'll have the authority to take the vote to put it in or out in the end, no matter what other committees do. So, you know, it'll be back in one way or another. I think we're just sort of, kind of stuck. As you've said, Representative Liebling, I agree, it's a problem, but I really don't think any of us would be comfortable sending the full bill out to civil law and back again. So there's not a lot of other options, I don't think, at this point, unless you have another way of thinking it through, Representative Liebling. Anyone, while you're thinking about that, anyone else? Representative Pratt.
Madam Chair, I'm in 100% agreement with you. While I trust our colleagues on civil law, it's not the tax committee. And if I were them, I'd create all sorts of really interesting tax amendments and then send the bill back to us to clean up. And I think it could create a very difficult scenario for all of us, not just sitting around the table, but for the folks in the audience and for folks who care about these issues as well, to try to figure out where they need to go. Do the people who generally sit in this audience then need to go to civil law just in case somebody creates a tax amendment that has an impact on their business or their life. So I do think that tax issues ought to stay in the tax committee. I would prefer that we take this section out. I think it has some challenges, clearly. It has some concerns, clearly. Let's send those along, and let's keep the rest of it here.
Further discussion? If not, the Representative Coles renews his motion to strike this section from the Department of Revenue's policy bill. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Okay, so we're going to, and I should say for the audience, I did make that request that Representative Woffler mentioned to me to request a local fiscal impact note, and I have done that. And actually, Ms. Carlson-Walroth is off getting a copy so committee members can see it. And so when civil law is done, we'll know what the cost is to the counties and the cities for this. I mean, it is, I think, fair to sort of view this as a cost increase to the local units of government if we don't resolve this. So we're going to get that back and see what it's going to cost the local units of government if the position of removal stays. So that should, we hope, we put a deadline in the letter hoping that we could get that local fiscal impact note to our local units of government, ASAP, so we'll be looking forward to that too. Okay, so thank you everybody who came. Sorry we haven't resolved it today, but we'll all be back on it in the future, so thank you for being here. So to the next section, back to the Department of Revenue. And we are on Article 4, Section 3, 2. Ms. Cadoon.
Oh, we forgot.
Madam Chair, we're on Article 4 still, and I'd hate to...
Right, Article 4.
Article 4. We just have a few more provisions to get through. I hate to mislead you, but there might be a few more controversies with the remaining items, but hopefully not as contentious as the last one.
And there are members. That's why I think this is helpful, because I think there's another one coming in Article... further in this article that has controversy as well and more testimony. Okay, welcome. Nice to see you again.
Yes, and again, my name is Harriet Sims with the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I will be walking you through the rest of Article 4, and we're starting at Section 3, which amends a section that deals with the Commissioner's authority to order reassessment. The section currently requires that there be a total reassessment if the assessor doesn't appraise at least one-fifth of all the parcels in the district during the year. The change would make this discretionary. The reason we are doing this is because the current statute doesn't allow for situations where there might be extenuating circumstances, and it's kind of a draconian method. Right now, most counties do comply, but there was a recent situation where there was a county that did not comply with the quintile, and one of the reasons was because of the flood. And in that situation, we should be able to deal with it in some other way. And so that's what Section 3 would do. Sections 4 and 5 then would require churches and schools who to file property tax exemption applications in the first instance in order to be exempt. It would not require any more filings after the initial filing, and it wouldn't apply to anybody that currently has an exemption. Section 6.
Pardon me, Ms. Sims. Question from Representative Coles on that section. Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, on Section 4, maybe Mr. Michael can help me. And this is kind of a geeky statutory construction question. I apologize. But why are we changing shall to must?
Mr. Michael.
And I thought we used shall and may in statutes instead of must and other verbs. Can you help me out?
Must statutes.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, I don't think there's any legal difference. Shall is appropriately used when you're conferring a duty on somebody. And in this instance, I personally, when I draft, do not like to use shall where it's passive. So if you have an inanimate object, I don't like to write, the report shall include this, because a report can't have a duty to do that. But in this case, a taxpayer shall, I mean, it seems like it's appropriate. Usually we use it with officials where we say the Commissioner of Revenue shall. I'm not sure why they decided to change shall to must here, but I don't think it has any legal effect.
Madam Chair, I'm not going to move to delete that. I was just really curious because I'd never seen that before.
What happened to the cat?
Did you
have
comment?
Representative Carlson said the must is stronger.
You know what? I think it's a great change, Madam Chair. I'm all for it.
Thank you. Ms. Sims.
Section 6 deals with the wind energy production.
I apologize, Ms. Sims. Representative Anderson. Didn't see you on the list.
No.
You're not on the list? Sorry. Well, we must start your hand moving. Sorry about that, Ms. Sims. Representative Loeffler. Sorry.
Sorry about that, Madam Chair. And Ms. Sims, on the issue of, you know, now churches and educational academies have to notify that they're taking over a property. How are you going to get that word out? I mean, in the city of Minneapolis, we increasingly have these small storefront churches that just pop up. They're not connected with any necessarily a denomination. We have for-profit training academies for post-high school education. I mean, how do you get the word out to the people who are kind of not in the mainstream? I mean, I assume that there is an addition to, you know, St. Thomas University, somebody would know about it. But some of these other occupational groups, I just don't know if they would even know that they had to do this.
Ms. Sims.
Representative Loeffler and Madam Chair, we have a lot of different ways to let people know what the requirements are, and we, our communications division, can target the messages to as many people as we're aware of. We're probably not going to get to somebody that's totally out of the loop, but that's the way I understand that we can get the word out. It would be no different than other kinds of law changes that may affect populations that aren't necessarily looking at law changes. We have a variety of ways of getting that word out.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Cadoon.
It's my understanding, too, this is basically was kind of current practice where we'd ask people if they were going to be an exempt, newly exempt property, that they would file an exemption certificate. There wasn't a requirement in law, so when somebody said, well, I don't have to do that, we really had no authority to tell them, well, yeah, you really should. So this was kind of current practice, and now we realize that it's probably best, obviously, to codify the current practice so they're required to file this. So if they want to become exempt, they'll certainly find out.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just concerned that we don't have some denomination that is legitimate, that is, you know, has a congregation and things, that newly acquires a piece of property and just would lose that exemption for that first year just because they didn't know. But I guess it's up to the local assessor to reach out to them.
All right. Ms. Sims.
Section 6 deals with the wind energy production tax to increase the default tax calculation from 40% to 60% of the nameplate capacity for owners that don't file reports with us by the due date. The issue is that these reports are due February 1st, and we have to certify the tax of the counties by the 28th. It's based on the capacity of the wind tower. Most of these companies do file timely, but we know of at least one situation where the person did not file, and we believe that it was because their actual capacity was over that 40%, and so that it would create a situation where somebody would get a tax break or a better situation by not filing. The reason we're going to 60% is that's under current technology. That's currently as efficient as they can get, so that we won't have to keep coming back. I'm told that the newer ones are coming online at about 35% to 45%. So this is kind of a problem that's looming in the future. Section 7 deals with manufactured home cooperatives and the way that the homestead benefits are calculated. The department's current interpretation is that it's calculated based on the total of all the lots occupied by the members, and that it then they would get a benefit. For the whole thing, and then would consist of one first tier class rate and one homestead credit for the park. And I understand that this may be one of those that may have a bit of controversy, but the department believes that, this represents what our interpretation, current interpretation of the statute is.
Okay, and I think if you can just do section 8 and 9, then we'll be through the department's testimony and all of it, then we can go back and take public testimony on anything else.
Okay.
Because I think there's someone here on section 7.
Okay.
Okay, but this way we can get through the department.
Pardon? Then again, section 8 has been removed from the bill, and that was the one that dealt with the assessor's testimony. And so all that's left is section 9 that deals, that does away with some obsolete references and updates references within the law that refer to property taxes on agricultural property, because we changed where those classifications were in the statute, and this just refers to the correct places in the statute where those classifications are.
Thank you, Ms. Sims. Okay, so is there any testimony on any of the rest of Article 4 other than the provisions that have been removed? Representative Coles?
Can I ask one question on Section 6?
Section 6.
Wind energy conversion system issue. We're raising that from 40 to 60% if a taxpayer is just untimely in getting the report to the department and, you know, it shows up on February 10th as opposed to February 1st or before February 1st is required. Are they given an adjustment to accurately reflect what their production was, or are they stuck with that 60% as a penalty for not getting it in on time?
Representative and Madam Chair, the current practice and the practice that we would be continuing would be when we find out what the correct amount is, then we will use that amount. So if somebody is late versus somebody just flat out doesn't file, we would correct that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Sims.
Thank you. Okay, so we have Representative Marquardt on the list. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. One quick question on Section 9. Will this impact or take any benefits away from anyone currently with Green Acres? I mean, is there any impact there in moving these payment dates?
Ms. Sims.
I mean, I, as you know, Madam Chair, that was a bit of a controversy last year.
And Madam Chair, I am not aware of anybody.
Welcome. I think someone's coming to help you out there. If you can identify yourself with the shaver.
Madam Chair, my name is Jason Nord. I work at the Department of Revenue. And Representative Marquardt, this could represent a little bit of a change. The choice we had to make was, because the reference to 2B3 was essentially a reference to ag land, and so now with 2A and 2B, the decision is it just 2A or is it 2A and 2B? So a person who could be affected by this change is if you're a property owner who has a parcel that is only 2B, you would no longer get the delayed due date for that parcel that is strictly 100% 2B. But if it's got any percentage of 2A on it, we give them the benefit of the later due date. So any parcel that is a mix of 2A and 2B gets the later due date. But if it's just the 2B parcel, it would not get the later due date. And you could have a situation where a farmer maybe has seven or eight parcels, and one or two of those parcels might be only 2B, and so they would have the earlier due date on those one or two parcels.
Madam Chair.
Councilor Markler.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Nord, for that. But that does, you know, just to keep things simple, you know, you're going to have people having this date and this date, and they're the landowner of the same area of land. I just see that as creating more confusion into a system that's already not real simple.
Mr. North.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, it is a choice to be made. The reason why we made the choice to just draft it as 2A is because we believe that the original rationale behind the later due date was connected to farm income being later in the season. And if you have a parcel that is just 2B and isn't tied to the farm income at all, we didn't see that it fit with the original rationale. But certainly if you wanted to, if the legislature wanted to include both 2A and 2B as the later due date, I don't think we have a strong opinion on that. We just had to make a choice.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just thinking it might just keep things simpler if we just left it there. And I don't know what the feelings of the committee is, but that would be my inclination, is just kind of leave well enough alone on that.
Representative Demarest, members, though, I do want to say we want to get through public testimony
before
we're done here on the other articles. But Representative Demarest, because if this is going to break into a whole Green Acres thing, we're way off. Okay? So, Representative Demarest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, Madam Chair, I'm just going to agree with Representative Marquardt. I think to keep it simple, you know, a lot of the 2B land is formerly agricultural land, and it's been put into trees or it's been done for conservation purposes. So I really think it should be all kept the same. And I would agree with Representative Marquardt that for purposes of simplicity, as well as, quite frankly, just so we don't have a disincentive, again, for some good cultural practices and what we're doing with some of the land, I think it should all be the same and should keep the later date.
Thank you. Okay. Further public testimony on Article 4 of the Department's Policy Bill. Please, come forward. And I'm not sure who these people are and what they're coming for, but I had heard that folks were here on Section 7, Manufactured Home Co-ops. Is that possibly you?
Yes.
Welcome. Please.
Thank you. My name is Ann Norton. I'm an attorney with Housing Preservation Project. I guarantee you I'm not one of those $3,000 a day attorneys. Housing Preservation Project is a legal and advocacy organization that's been around for about 11 years. Our primary purpose is to preserve existing affordable housing and get more affordable housing built. And I'm here today with my colleague Kevin Walker, and we have another witness also if there's time. We are opposing the provisions of Article 4, Section 7. Having to do with manufactured home cooperatives. We believe that this is not an innocuous change, that this is a substantive and very significant change to the current law. We have submitted a letter. I believe it may be in your packets.
Yes, it's being passed out right now. Please.
Thank you very much. This provision concerns the taxation of entities called manufactured home park cooperatives. And these are cooperative organizations that are owned by the member residents of mobile home parks who have purchased their communities. This is a growing phenomenon of residents to purchase their communities. It's a good thing. It's being done across the country. There are now four in the state of Minnesota representing 330 homeowners. There are another two that are in process, and there are likely to be more, as my understanding is that the Minnesota Housing Agency is working in collaboration with North Country Development, Mr. Walker is representing them today, to develop more of these communities. And the reason is that by owners purchasing these communities from the investor owners of the land, it ensures the ongoing affordability of the communities, it ensures more stability of the communities, it allows owners and gives them the incentive to improve their homes and the communities. So this is a very positive thing, not only for the owners who live in these communities, but also the neighboring communities in which they're located. We believe that this change to the, that this proposal will significantly change and hurt these communities by changing the language of the statute. And specifically, right now, we believe that the current language provides that each lot that's owned by a member owner, a member of the cooperative, should receive the benefit of the market value credit, the homestead credit, and the 1% tax rate. The department, we believe, is proposing to change that methodology so that the market value credit and the 1% assessment would apply to the aggregate of the lots that are occupied by member residents of these communities. In effect, that means that they would not get the benefit of that type of homestead treatment. It's our understanding that this is the only type of cooperative. There are many different types of housing cooperatives in the state of Minnesota that are provided homeowner benefits in 273.1.24. This then would be singled out by this language to be treated completely differently than the other kinds of housing cooperatives in this in our state. We believe that this is, again, is a significant change that will have negative financial impacts for the residents of these communities. Thank you. And we're opposing it. We hope that you will also. And we also welcome the opportunity to meet with you to discuss this further. Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Thank
you.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Hi, I am Kevin Walker, Housing Development Director at North Country Cooperative Foundation. We're a 501c3 organization that, as Ann mentioned, since 2004. We've worked successfully with the residents of four manufactured home communities, also known as mobile home parks, to help them organize cooperatives and purchase their communities from investor owners. Today, then, there are over 330 manufactured homeowners and four cooperatives around the state of Minnesota. Two other projects are actively in our pipeline with others on the way. Manufactured housing cooperatives essentially deliver to their homeowners the following three benefits: security, democracy, and essentially the pursuit of happiness, or the opportunity to pursue happiness on a totally different platform. First, in terms of security, 6 to 8 of these communities close every year, often due to some commercial redevelopment pressures, or in some cases, other kinds of public sector projects. Secondly, on the democracy front, it provides autonomy and a direct voice in the operations and management of the communities themselves to the homeowners that work very hard together to organize these cooperatives and purchase their communities. And thirdly, it sets them up for the long term for a much better economic situation. They operate the communities at cost. Over time, what's been shown around the country is that this will stabilize the lot rents over time, and it provides a long-term platform for income and asset building for some of the lowest income manufactured homeowners in the state. Statewide in Minnesota, there are 50,000 units of basically lots that exist in investor-owned communities, and there are almost 1,000 investor-owned manufactured home communities. It's a large portion of the affordable housing stock in Minnesota. In fact, in number, it's greater than that of all of the publicly subsidized portfolio of projects across HUD, USDA, and the other various programs around the state. So it's a major part of the housing picture in our state. These are, as I've said, delivered, manufactured housing cooperatives deliver the full benefit of home ownership to the lowest income homeowners in the state. As you may know, in an investor-owned community, folks generally own their manufactured homes, but they're put on land that they don't own and that they don't control. And they organize these cooperatives so as to have that full control, which in turn, over the long run, will set them up for better terms of financing on their homes, longer-term fixed-rate financing. It's part of a larger effort to build income and assets of low-income homeowners around the country. Nationally, there are 1,000 manufactured housing cooperatives. We're in the early stages of this. As I've said, our first project was in 2004, and there are more down the pike. The irony in this proposal is that by stipulating a radically different and unique approach to calculating homestead tax treatment, it provides to this group a form of homestead tax treatment that is good only on paper. And when you do the math and you look at the value of these communities, the value of the homestead tax treatment basically falls off the table, and these homeowners don't get it. That's basically the effect of this proposal. And that's in contrast to the fact, again, that every other homeownership co-op, every condominium, every townhome association, multifamily form of homeownership, that's not how it works. This isn't how you calculate it. And lastly, and I know we're time sensitive here, The impacts to the low-income Minnesota homeowners will be measured in the tens of thousands of dollars. For the state's largest manufactured housing cooperative, we have a representative from their board here today, the tax impact of this proposal would be over $24,000 to the community. And the irony in all of this is that the proposal is not only at odds with how every other homeownership, cooperative, condominium, townhome is treated in the state, but on top of it, it's at odds with the state's own housing finance agency, which literally last month rolled out a $15 million proposal to provide financing for this kind of cooperative. And that's in full recognition of the public purpose that these cooperatives afford the homeowners and the long-term affordable housing preservation that it represents for the state. Thanks for your consideration. We've also had some contact with the State Department of Revenue staff, and we have one meeting scheduled for later in the week to hopefully work with them. To the degree that there's administrative issues or challenges in interpreting present statute, we're happy to help with that. We do not think that a statutory change is in order here. Thank you.
Thank you. Rep. Sam Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to speed things up a bit, I'd like to move my A6 amendment, which just asked us to delete Section 7 in Article 4. I don't know if everybody has it, but it's just...
Okay. It's being passed out. Rep. Sam Gardner moves H2972A6 amendment. Rep. Sam Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've had a history in my short time in the legislature working with advocates for manufactured housing, and manufactured housing has a long history of being treated differently and not on an equal basis with other types of housing, and I think this is another example, and so... I think we ought to let this negotiation work its course and take it out of the bill.
Discussion to the Gardner Amendment. Representative Coles.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm inclined to support Representative Gardner and his amendment, but I guess I'd at least be willing to hear from the department as to why they think we should be making this change. I just kind of explained quickly as we went through, but I think I agree with Representative Gardner on this. If we treat condominium units and others differently, I'm not sure why we're doing this unique treatment here, but maybe the department can help out.
Well, Ms. Sims, you walked through it once. I don't know if there's something you want to add, Ms. Sims or Ms. Cadoon. Mr. Nord, yes, that's right. You showed up again. Okay, thank you. You heard Representative Cole's question?
Madam Chair, I believe I've heard most of it.
Okay.
I guess what we're trying to do here is make the statute more clearly read what our current interpretation is. So if you take it out of the bill, it doesn't change our current interpretation. We would still administer the law in this manner or still provide advice to the counties in this manner. We're just trying to eliminate some of the confusion in reading of the law. And the reason why the fundamental problem that needs to be addressed is personal property is taxed and assessed in the same year, but real property is assessed in one year and taxed in another year. So it's impossible to calculate a market value homestead credit for a piece of real property and a piece of personal property together, because you have to extend that calculation over a two-year period. So we're not able to just cleanly calculate a credit for each one of these lots. It just doesn't work. And so we need some clarification. We've made an interpretation of this law. We're trying to codify that interpretation. And we're certainly open to talking to interested parties as to how the law can change and how the interpretation can change and go in a different direction. But we need some clarification.
Representative Colt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I understand now the department's quandary, but I still think this is something that needs some additional work, and since we've already decided to take some other things out that need additional work, I'm gonna support Representative Gardner's amendment at this point in time. But I think I understand what the quandary is that the department is faced with, and I think I see how it's different than other common real estate ownership issues.
Okay, Representative Gardner, to your motion.
Madam Chair, I was just renew my motion to pass the A6 amendment, and I hope the stakeholders can keep talking.
Okay, discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion carries, and the A6 is added to the policy bill. Members, we still have two amendments that are not related, as far as I can tell, to anything. They're not on an article in the bill. One is a Marquardt amendment, and one is a Downey amendment.
and they are not in your packets, and we're going to be out of time in about 7 minutes. Do the authors want to work these through right now or take them up when we come back again? Representative Downey?
Madam Chair, I can temporarily withdraw it if there's another opportunity.
Okay, Representative Mark, what would you like to do?
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, we can, whatever you would like. I mean, we might be able to, I think we can get it done in 7 minutes, but I can certainly come back and do it later.
Well, let's take a start on, you know, whoever wants to offer one. See if we can get through, I think. Do you want to wait? Representative Marquardt. Okay.
All right. So I will thank you very much, Representative Downey, for deferring, and I will then move the A4 amendment.
Representative Marquardt moves the A4 amendment. It's being passed out now, and I'm going to assume, looking at Ms. Cadoon, while that's being passed out, that the A10-2129 amendment that Ms. Cadoon brought is now off the table for today. Okay, so that one's done. Okay, we discussed that earlier. So on the Marquardt A4 amendment.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Members, what this does is last year it was passed into law, and it dealt with insurance companies. And when insurance companies had claims, they over $50,000, the interest rate they would have to pay on those claims went up to 10%. And well, I understand the reasoning behind that is that a lot of times they would hold off on claims because the old percentage was 4% that they had to pay back. So if they had these funds in higher interest-bearing accounts, they would actually make some money, hold on to that, and then pay off the claim. So it was supposed to deal, so they upped it to 10% on any claims over $50,000. It was supposed to deal only with insurance companies. Lo and behold, what we found out is that it also applies to tax court settlements, which means the loser in a case of a tax court, which could either be an individual or a taxpayer or a local units of government, now would have to pay this 10%. The previous law, and this is what this would do, is take just those parts dealing with the tax court under Chapter 549, and the interest rate would go back to current state law, which is the greater interest rate of whatever the interest is on treasury bills, or 4%, which right now would be 4%. So that's the amendment. It's really going back to what the intent of the law was. There was not an intent to also include tax court, which it ended up doing. So.
Okay. Ms. Cadoon, thoughts on the amendment from the department's perspective? Have you seen it? I know you're aware of the issue because I think you mentioned it to me quite a while ago.
Yep, Madam Chair. Yeah, we were certainly aware of this issue. We're certainly supportive that this was an inadvertent change in the Department of Public Safety bill last year, which we were, I think, all caught off guard when we found out the result of it. So we're certainly supportive of it. Just to let you know that this would have a budget impact to the positive, so it would be a positive general fund. It would be a revenue gain because it's now a forecast adjustment that it's currently a calculation at 10%. So it also be a positive gain on the county level as well.
Okay. Representative Marquardt, further?
No.
Okay. Others? I think, members, the way I understand it is sort of an oversight, and I don't think it's too controversial. Does anyone have any other discussion? Any testimony on the Marquardt Amendment? All those in favor of the A4 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion carries. A4 is adopted. Representative Downey. And if we could get a page here. Do you have a copy in front of you?
Is it still 0222-1?
Yes. Yeah. Representative Downey moves the 0222-1 amendment and pages. Oh, yeah. You could pass one of these out there. Thank you. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a common sense, normal citizen language change amendment. When I first came down to the legislature and began sitting on this tax committee, it took me a while to understand the language, and I think some of that is reflective of the fact that this committee tends to be very focused on the revenue pie chart of the state, and at times is a little bit overly focused on that from my perspective. So the hope here is that we could make this language change to the current tax expenditure report, which I never understood how it was that allowing somebody to get tax relief and kind of retain ownership of their own income or the profits from their business would somehow be considered an expenditure. And the
comments made at the Angel Investment Tax Credit hearing, wherein the tax credit was described as a subsidy to these businesses, frankly, I think took many of the attendees, the citizen attendees, the business people in the audience by surprise, and frankly took a little bit of offense. So I'd just like to suggest that we change the vernacular of the tax expenditure report to a tax freedoms and expenditure report. And everywhere in the report that we're referring to non-refundable credits, so we call that a tax freedom as compared to an expenditure, because it doesn't seem to me that we are expending any state funds. Actually, we are relieving the citizen of having to expend their own funds to the state. So the hope is that we could actually reverse some of the terminology here and become more aware of what's going on with ordinary citizens out in the real world. We're very focused on the pie chart here. We tend to look at the pie chart and see the entire world through the lens of state government as the center of the universe, and I would request this amendment be passed so that we can actually be reflective of how people, I think, out there in the real world perceive government revenues as compared to expenditures. And if I could have a roll call, please.
Okay, Representative Downey requests a roll call on the 0222-1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. Any Madam public Chair. Testimony on this? Okay, Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate this. If you remember last year in the tax bill, Representative Lucheski, you kind of led the effort to really scrutinize these tax expenditures. And we do know that while these tax expenditures do provide tax freedoms for some, it provides tax burdens for others, because many, as we found out, do not qualify for some of these tax expenditures where others do, and because there's less revenue coming in, it means they pay more somewhere else. So I think it would be inaccurate to say that tax expenditures are tax freedoms, because for some they are, and for some they're burdened. So I would be opposed to this amendment.
Okay, Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Marquardt. I hope that we'll hear that same debate on tonight on the debt bill, the bonding bill, because I do think that there is a fundamental, just philosophical difference that we seem to have related to what creates jobs and how jobs are actually created in the private economy. And we're going to hear tonight, we already heard it this afternoon, that we're going to be voting on a jobs bill. Yet when we bring forward tax cuts that allow the private economy to work, when we bring forward proposals that allow small business owners to keep more of their money, those are argued as expenditures of the state, not as tax cuts or a jobs bill that allows more jobs to be created in our economy. So I think that this is a really good discussion to have. I appreciate Representative Downey bringing this forward. I think he brings it forward as somebody who's just shocked at the language of government. And I think the language of government is something that's very important as we go forward. And so I hope members will vote with us on this. We'll talk about jobs tonight. We'll talk about them tomorrow. We ought to talk about them every day. But I do think that allowing people to keep their own money and reinvest in their communities, reinvest in creation of jobs, is an important component of, I would argue, the most important component of actually creating those jobs out in the private market.
Further discussion? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I would move an amendment to the amendment. I would move to amend everywhere it says freedoms to change that to preferences. I'm doing that. I think that is what Representative Marquardt explained, I think, is absolutely right on, that really these are freedoms for some, but really what they are is preferences. Somebody's getting something special in the tax code. So that would be my amendment to the amendment.
Okay, so Representative Liebling moves an amendment to the 0222-1 amendment, substituting the word preferences wherever the word freedoms is. Does everyone understand that, or do we need to have staff actually write that all out? Everyone understands that? Okay, good. To the Liebling amendment to the amendment, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd ask for a roll call on the amendment to my amendment and would argue against it. And it's interesting because the comments by Representative Liebling and Representative Marquardt are exactly what is backwards and upside down in my mind. This sense that the government somehow is entitled to every dollar you earn, and we grant you the ability to keep it at certain points in time when we feel like we are granting you a preference, is exactly what I don't understand. And the very term expenditure, if you look it up in the dictionary, that's somebody expending funds. We don't expend any funds when we allow somebody to keep their hard-earned money. There were numerous proposals last year to eliminate a number of credits, including home interest and charitable deductions to a certain extent. Yeah. And the message we were continually sending to the citizens of this state is that somehow we own all this down here in government. And we're sitting on the edge of this state revenue pie chart looking in only. And we don't look out at the broader world and realize the implications of what we're doing. And this sense that we at state government own all that money, and when we allow you to get it back, that we're giving you a preference, that is just fundamentally upside down. And that's what the language of my original amendment is intended to put into statute. So I'd argue against the Liebling amendment to my amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tamney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have to agree with Representative Downey. The description he gave of the debate, that the government is eligible for every last dollar you make, if anybody here made that argument, I would agree with him. That doesn't make any sense. I didn't hear anybody make that argument. I think what's going on here is the fundamental tax policy question of, should similarly situated people be taxed similarly? And if I've got business A in my district that makes X amount of money and has X amount of profit and X amount of tax liability then, and I've got business B that is equal in all those measures except it offers discounted bus passes to its employees, we give it a tax preference. Because it's only fair that similarly situated entities or individuals should pay the same level of taxes. And what we say is, if you do something different, we're going to give you a little bonus. Representative Downey, are you now opposed to the Angel Investor Tax Credit? Because that's exactly what it says. If you make a certain amount of money and you owe a certain amount of taxes, you and I should be assessed the same, but if one of us engages in a different behavior, we're going to give you a preference. We're going to give you an incentive. So I think, Representative Downey, I'd agree with you if your description of the debate was anything close to accurate. But I think it was a significant misstatement of Representative Marquardt, from the, what I heard, Representative Liebling, and a distortion of what the debate is. I think Representative Liebling's amendment to the amendment is accurate. These are preferences that we give people for certain behaviors. I'd support the amendment to the amendment.
Further discussion? Members, I just, my two cents, I support the Liebling amendment. I actually, I think these kind of things personally are just a symptom of the hard reality that we're all facing as both parties. Everybody's looking for a way to not have to do what has to be done, and I understand that, and we've kind of clocked through the shifts and gimmicks and everything long before Representative Dabney was here, who's the original author. And so now this, to me, is a new attempt to not face the reality we're under and start calling things that cost us money free. And they're not free. They cost us money. People may not like that they're called tax expenditures and they'd like different terms, but the fact to me is, you know, if 10 people have to contribute $10 for a $100 program and you let one person off the hook, you know, the other 10 don't get, or the other 9 don't get to keep giving 10. They now have to make up for the other guy. And that's the tax burden that increases on them as someone else gets a preference. So I understand that people wish we did some other kind of forecasting and modeling and these things really didn't count and they weren't really numbers on a spreadsheet. Because if they didn't count, we could just solve the deficit through rhetoric. But it's just not going to work. If we give someone a preference that someone else doesn't get, we have to account for it. And if you know, folks, this is a recurring problem with dynamic scoring and modeling, where I think members on both sides of the aisle, this is not a Republican or Democratic thing, just don't want to face what's coming. And so when you can give things to people and pretend they don't cost money, that feels good. Or when you can buy stuff and hope it's free, or you can take things away and not hurt people, or you can raise people's taxes and not hurt them, those would all be great things, but none of them, in my mind, are real. And so I would strongly urge members to, I guess, support the Liebling Amendment first. I don't know if then Representative Downey will want to
continue on. But, you know, I do think it's language is important. I think there's a continuum from handout to subsidy to new spending program to tax cut. And people can pick where they want to be on the rhetorical amendment when they, or the rhetoric when they buy something. I've tried to stay away from pejoratives like, you know, handouts. And I personally don't think I've used subsidy. I call them new spending programs because from the legislature's perspective, they are. I mean, and that's okay. I mean, it's okay to be for new spending programs. Let's say you're for new K-12 spending or the angel investor credit. It doesn't matter what they are. They're spending items on the spreadsheet. And so I know people would like to not count them that way. But if we were to pass if we were going to begin to start acting like they don't count, we could just take a magic wand and make the deficit go away. And we could feel good passing that, but it wouldn't really change the hard economic reality that Minnesota's under. So I support the labeling language change, and if there's no other discussion, we'll take the roll.
Lincheski.
Yes.
Anderson.
No.
Broad.
No.
Carlson.
Aye.
David. Dabney.
Aye.
Demmer.
No.
Still.
Dietrich.
Aye.
Downey.
No.
Eastland.
No.
Gardner.
Aye.
Garofalo.
Nope.
Hillstrom.
Koonin.
Aye.
Coles.
No.
Lanny.
No.
Lesch. Liebling.
Aye.
Loon.
No.
Marquardt.
Aye.
Mullery. Murphy.
Aye.
Reiner.
No.
Rukavina.
Aye.
Rude.
Aye.
Solver. Tilbury.
Aye.
Zellers. Davids. Dill. Hillstrom. Lesch. Mullery. Solver.
Mm-hmm. So reading 13 yeses, 10 nays, the Liebling amendment to the amendment passes. And now to Representative Downey's amendment. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll just try and wrap this up quickly. I just was noting the terminology and the sentence structure of the debate on that Liebling amendment, and I heard a number of times, if we give somebody, and you can count a tax credit as new spending, and from the legislature's perspective, and that's really what I'm trying to get at with this amendment, is to ask us to take a hard look at how focused we are and how state-centric we are on this committee and in many other places. But to spare the rest of the proceedings here, I'll withdraw my amendment and leave it at that.
Okay,
thank
so
you.
Representative Downey withdraws his amendment. Members, I think Representative Marquardt and maybe Demmer here were quick trying to do. Were you interested in amending your thoughts on Green Acres and clarifying that? Would you need a verbal amendment on that?
You know, Madam Chair, if, or even Representative Demmer, if we could delete Article 4, Section 9, dealing with here. Moving up that 2B payment date. And Representative Demmer, if you would want to offer that amendment, just been signed.
Okay, and I want to apologize while you think about that. Representative Eastland, do you have an amendment? I did not know that. I apologize.
I have a couple of amendments in the packet, and I guess I brought them here. I didn't know if there was it's appropriate that it could go on this bill, but they're Green Acres having to do with the date.
Okay.
And I know there's been talk about moving that date back to August.
Okay.
And I guess the concern I have is that it seems like we continue to move the date incrementally, and then we're forced with having to move it again and again. And I guess I took a different approach and said, let's look at the backside of this, 2013, when the whole thing has to be completed, and then let's work from the back and see if we can come up with some dates so we could be a little more generous in giving people the time. So I have two amendments. One was just to move the date back to 2012. That they have to declare their intentions, and understanding human nature, I know that wouldn't work because they would just wait until 2012. And so I put together a different philosophy, which was to move the date back to August, and then give them additional time after August, but they would lose the benefit of the forgiveness for giving the Green Acres penalty. And so I have two amendments in that I've given them to Representative Marquardt, because I believe they should go to his committee and be discussed rather than just slapped on this bill. Okay. But I just wanted to bring them up and say that this is an issue I think we need to discuss and get some input from everybody on, but there are two options that I think are...
And I apologize. When I was asking, I thought we just had Downey and Marquardt, so my apology. So this is a little more extensive and we're over time, so I guess it sounds like you want to talk to Representative Marquardt a little bit. So can we take it up next time?
I've given him the copies of the bills, and I think we should discuss it in his committee somehow rather than just put it on this bill, even though we could put it on this bill here. But.
Okay, great. Well, I think that's what we'll do then, and we can hear back what you want to do next, Representative Neeson, when we meet again. So if there's another amendment, otherwise we're going to adjourn. Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'll offer the amendment then to on page 14, section 9. Actually, we're just deleting section 9, I think. And that'd be an oral amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Marquardt, this is the obsolete reference in Section 9. There was some clarity. We heard the discussion. Testimony on this? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion carries, and the Demmer Amendment is added. Members, we're adjourned. Thank you.